right, please be seated. Good morning. The third case on this morning's oral argument calendar for the Southern Panel is City of Las Vegas versus Lawson. Ms. Lynn, are you ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to thank the court for my appearance. My name is Jill Lynn. I'm here on behalf of the City of Las Vegas, and we're the appellant in this matter. I'd like to thank the court for entertaining oral argument on this issue. It is a matter of extreme importance as far as the statutory interpretation of NRS 617-453 and its impact on the classification of benefits in essence. And I just wanted also to state that please know that the benefits in this case have been paid. There is no treatment that has been denied. The course of treatment, in fact, was largely done by the primary structure. So it is not a matter of claim acceptance, claim denial, and denial of treatment from a medical standpoint. The situation here, Your Honor, that we have is we need to determine, obviously with your guidance, and that's why we're here, as to how to classify benefits as far as the cancer caused in firefighters. The statute which has been promulgated before you, and we're asking for your interpretation, and this is a matter of first impression. Is this workers' compensation, or is it condition that should be covered under the regular health plan? The distinction between the two is basically compensation benefits, wage replacement. In either plan, right, whether it's regular health plan or it's workers' compensation, the claimant, Ms. Lawson, is covered. It's just a matter of how do we classify the benefits for by purposes of the statute and moving forward. I think you're also familiar, and I'm not sure if this was touched on very much in the over 1,200 pages that you've reviewed in this matter, that the significance as far as the classification comes in that if these benefits are deemed presumptive or conclusive, the funding for that has to be accounted for in every municipality's budget. So we need to know whether we have to fund these mandates. And we can't have an unfunded mandate, so we need to determine the scope of that mandate and how much that is going to cost going forward. Specifically, I asked to the budgets concerning firefighters and the city of self-insured, as you know.
Council, very bluntly, it's kind of the cost of doing business. So if we can get into this argument in terms of what the burden is of the parties, I'd like to get there.
Sure, I can do that, Your Honor. The statute 617-453 is problematic in its interpretation and application. The statute provides that for, and for the record, the title is Cancer as Occupational Disease of Firefighters. The requirements in order for cancer to be deemed an occupational disease of firefighters are twofold. One, you must be a firefighter for 5 years or more. Two, you must demonstrate, and I specific here after the language says it is demonstrated. It doesn't say who has to demonstrate, but by whom that demonstration is required. Simply, it is demonstrated that the firefighter was exposed while in the course of the employment to a known carcinogen as defined by the IARC or the NTP, and the carcinogen is reasonably associated with a disabling cancer. All right, that becomes problematic. Subsection 2, there is a schedule of certain carcinogens which are deemed reasonably associated with certain cancers. As you can see, formaldehyde and vinyl chloride are associated reasonably by the NTP and/or the IARC with brain cancer and so forth. Unfortunately, missing from this schedule is breast cancer. Now, the list is not exclusive. And in subsection 3, statute provides that it is not an exclusive list and does not preclude any person from demonstrating on a case-by-case basis for the purposes of paragraph D above that a substance is a known carcinogen that is reasonably associated with a disabling cancer. So that's the statutory structure that we're dealing with. Problematic in that in application, the statute does not give us any indication as to who is to determine on a case-by-case basis, whose burden of proof a demonstration of the reasonable association with the disabling cancer and a carcinogen, who that burden rests with. And then, beyond that, The other portion of the statute which is especially problematic is regarding the presumption. The statute expressly states that this is not a conclusive presumption. I would submit that that is a distinction without difference right now between a conclusive presumption and a rebuttable presumption. We have no guidance by the statute, and we have no case law to indicate what the standard is for the city of Las Vegas in this instance to rebut the presumption. We don't know what the standard is. We don't know what the factors are. We don't know what the requirement for a successful rebuttal is. And I would suggest that by the breadth of the statute and the, in my opinion, it's extremely overbroad, makes that even more difficult and, in essence, makes it a conclusive presumption. So our position and our interpretation of the statute is that based on the facts we have here, which I can address any specific ones if you wish me to go to more specifics, I'd be happy to. What we have here is a female firefighter with breast cancer. There was a diagnosis in 1997, diagnosis in 2004, 2005. The 1997 was not put forward as a workers' compensation claim. It was not filed as a workers' compensation claim until 2005. In fact, after the a second surgery for the breast cancer. So looking at this after the fact, we have to create the situation going forward as far as what is the carcinogen and what is the disabling cancer. Okay, the carcinogen that's been offered by Mr. Gross is, let me get this right, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. I'm not a scientist, so I apologize if I butcher that. And the other substance is benzene. It's been benzene is pretty much everything. It emits from these carpets. It emits from the polish on this furniture. It is almost impossible to be in an environment that does not have benzene. Needless to say, is there a heightened risk of exposure as a firefighter? Certainly. But does it fit within the statute? And does it make it a compensable workers' compensation claim? It's our position that, especially with these facts, that it does not. I don't think there's anyone in this room who hasn't been touched by breast cancer in some manner. Sister, mother, daughter. It's pervasive. And, of course, that fight continues. And the Nevada legislature and the attempt to carve out a special exception for those employees who throw in fight fires has come up with this language. The problem is the language is so overbroad and the burden is so ill-defined that it has made it a conclusive presumption, which the statute expresses it is not supposed to be. So
are you urging us to revise the statute?
Oh, I understand, Your Honor, that that's impossible. What we're seeking here today is some clear direction as to its application. Because this is an issue, now today it's relative to breast cancer. Tomorrow it could be very easily a different cancer that's not on the scheduled list. At this juncture, until the legislature deems it appropriate to act and change the statute, we need to know how to apply it. And that's what we're here seeking guidance from you for. I believe you're familiar with our position throughout the course of these proceedings. It's actually the appeals officer here, and I think it's pretty clear in the record, in the transcripts especially, from the experts. The requirements that are set forth in the statute have not been met. She felt otherwise. She deemed that they were sufficient to meet the burden in the statute. We disagree. The very documents and reports and studies relied upon by the claimant's expert here, Dr. Emilius, are in fact the very studies that do not support inclusion of breast cancer or the conclusion that breast cancer is reasonably associated with benzene or PAHs, polyaromatic hydrocarbons. In fact, the only study of any kind of significance was from Florida. Where 2,007 female firefighters and almost 40,000 male firefighters were tracked over a period of 4 or 5 years relative to the increased incidence of breast cancer.
You're faulting the epidemiology in that study. Well, however, the question I have is, doesn't this statute say that when the epidemiology has not yet caught up with the claim, if there is a doctor, however imperfect his scientific basis, that will make that connection between exposure to a toxin and a particular cancer, that presumption goes to the firefighter in that situation? That's what the statute says. So from the state side of this, what was put forward affirmatively to divorce exposure to PHP and benzenes from the cancer that this individual suffered?
If I'm understanding you correctly, I think I agree with you partially. The disabling cancer being breast cancer and the carcinogens that were deemed reasonably associated with that disabling cancer being PAHs and benzene. Now, the studies relied upon for that do not bear that out, unfortunately. The expert did, and it's in the record clear, that he said that he does believe that there's an association between those chemicals and breast cancer. And when asked further, what is that belief based upon? And he indicated based upon largely these studies, these epidemiological studies, and studies of firefighters over a period of time, the main one of which is the Florida study. And if you look at the Florida study, however, the significant language in here, and I can just quote from it briefly, and that being, and I'm quoting, among female firefighters, there was no significant increase or decrease of overall cancer mortality of any site-specific cancer, including breast and lung. So
but the study was showing an uptick in male breast cancer, correct?
That was it, yes.
And that was abnormal to that cohort in the population.
Correct.
And it also shows that the impact of PHP and benzene in producing breast cancer in males was, there's no reason to believe that it would be sex specific. That's the line of, that's the logic that takes that doctor to the opinion he gives, correct?
That is partially what he relies upon, yes, Your Honor. I can't disagree with that.
Counsel, more specifically though, continuing on that, with that, to the crux of the matter, in this two-step test as we get into the carcinogen is reasonably associated with disabling cancer, how should we look at that term of art, reasonably associated? What's your take from the city standpoint? That's the crux of what we got.
Yeah, I agree and I understand, and that is our interpretation of reasonably associated. It's based upon the medical literature. Same thing that everyone else looks at, matter of interpretation. Now, reasonably associated by the factors and the standards that they set forth in the statute being the IARC list and the NTP list. Now, the NTP list, although they're basically similar, the NTP list lists certain carcinogens which they believe to be reasonably associated with human cancers. The IARC has four different categories, similar structure though. And when you go by each of those guidelines, PAHs as well as benzene are not deemed to be reasonably associated with breast cancer. That's the very standard they set forth in the statute. Look to these guys. And that's how you determine whether something is reasonably associated with a certain disabling cancer. When you look to the IARC, similar results. The difference being that the categories are not identical. So a reasonable association, according to the IARC list, includes benzene. Now, the other list does not. The statute provides that it can be either list, either the IARC list or the NTP. It doesn't make it a requirement that it be on both lists. So that is one basis that we use to try to understand and interpret reasonable association. And back to the fact of this instance, I think also the fact that there are many, many life stressors and environmental impacts, or environmental factors, rather, excuse me, that impact family history, hormone replacement, smoking, of course. Specific to this case, we have an 8-year history of smoking. We have a history of oral contraceptives. We have a family history. Not all of this was known to Dr. Melius, and I think that was clear in the record, and I can go back into that at the conclusion if you wish me to. However, there are numerous factors that I think bear out the fact that it cannot be reasonably associated that these carcinogens are related to the Save Lake Cancer here, breast cancer, by the medical scientific data.
Would you agree that the evidence of record, though, would provide the association between male firefighters and breast cancer because of their exposure to benzenes and the pH?
I'm sorry, Aaron, I'm not following
you. Does the record demonstrate a link, in your estimation, if she were male, that the breast cancer would have had a reasonable association with the occupational exposure?
I don't know that I can answer that.
Because the Florida study does show an uptick in male breast cancer.
Right, but if you extrapolate that over the cohort studies for mortality and cancer survival rates nationwide, that number changes. So the premise being, if we accept that premise, yes, there would be, but I don't know that that there is enough information to make that a reasonable premise. I'll reserve whatever time I have remaining.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lynn. all right, Mr. Gross.
Good morning. Martin Gross on behalf of Robin Lawson, the respondent in this matter. To answer the question that was raised earlier, this statute is not a conclusive presumption. It says so on its face. If you want to look in your past decisions for the operation of a conclusive presumption, you can look no farther back than I think 4 years ago in a case called Clark County versus Manuel, which is a case involving heart disease under NRS 617.57. In that case, what the court decided was that once it had been shown that the firefighter had satisfied the statutory prerequisites of 5 years continuous employment, and it had been shown that he suffered from heart disease, that's where the inquiry stopped. Because the argument in that case had been that the gentleman suffered from a congenital malformation in his heart, and the court, in reversing the appeals officer's decision, simply said, once he satisfied the prerequisites of the statute, a conclusive presumption operates to stop any further inquiry at that point in time, and that's not this statute. I think the best way to try to analyze this case is to use the analysis which you authored, Justice Hardesty, in the Milko case, where you discussed the operation of presumption there. And what you said was, let's look at the basic facts, see what those facts need to be established, and then let's look and see what benefit the party in whose favor the presumption operates, to see what they get, so to speak, as the benefit of establishing the basic facts of the presumption. Here, the necessary basic facts would have been that Ms. Lawson was exposed, that she was exposed to a known carcinogen as identified on one of the two listings, and that medical evidence established a reasonable association between the cancer that she suffered from, in this case breast cancer, and the carcinogen to which she was exposed. And so, to review the evidence, was she exposed? The answer to that is yes. How did we establish that? We established it through her own testimony, the testimony of her supervisor, Captain Pope, and the logs of the runs that her engine company made throughout the term of her employment.
Counsel, how do we deal, though, again, and you use the term of art, reasonable association?
Medical proof. And so if we accept, as the appeals officer found, that she was exposed.
What if the medical proof is, in this case, call it conflicting at best? How do we determine what is reasonable to push it one way or the other?
I think there are two answers to that. One is, you start from the assumption that this court has always articulated, which is there substantial evidence in the record to support a fact adjudicator's determination? Because this court isn't to act as a fact finder and reweigh the evidence. And so to then go back and analyze was there evidence in this record which a reasonable person would assume was adequate to support that finding that the fact finder made, that indeed there was a reasonable association between the exposure to benzene PAHs and breast cancer? The answer to that is, number one, Dr. Melius. Dr. Melius is board certified in occupational medicine. He's not only a medical doctor, he's got a PhD in epidemiology. So would a reasonable person rely on that type of individual's testimony in aiding their understanding as to whether or not the evidence shows that association between breast cancer and this particular type of exposure? And I think the answer to that is yes. Would you rely upon a doctor whose training is in occupational medicine, who's authored articles about firefighters and their exposures to various chemicals in the workplace, and has authored articles about the relationship between chemical exposures and breast cancer? And I think a reasonable person would rely on such a person. And so, to answer your question, there is evidence in the record consisting of Dr. Melius's testimony, who I believe is a qualified expert, that I think a reasonable person would rely on in establishing a reasonable association between exposure to benzene and PAHs and breast cancer.
But the state's, or the city's point is that when asked what he bases his opinion on, he refers to studies that don't support the opinion and indeed show no correlation. Could you address that?
I think if you go back and read those studies, to the extent we as lawyers can understand those, which is difficult, they do show to some extent, and I'll grant you that, I'm trying to think of the right word, there is some guarding in the people that are expressing an opinion as to whether or not they can show a direct correlation. And certainly the Florida study, which even the city's expert agreed was the best study that we had, and this is a study that's a retrospective analysis of mortality based upon a population of both male and female firefighters from 1972 to 1999. Well, unfortunately, one of the things that you have to recall, during that time period, historically, somewhat different today, but not entirely, is firefighting was not a, what we'll say, gender equal occupation in the early 70s. For that matter, neither was going to law school, I suppose. But at that time, even when you look back at that population, and unfortunately, it indicated one female death due to breast cancer. But as Dr. Melius testified, his interpretation of that study showed a sevenfold increase in death to males for breast cancer.
And no explanation for why that would be gender specific.
The testimony that he gave and the testimony that Dr. Petrush, the city's expert, gave was that physiologically and morphologically there was no difference between males and females and their reaction to a carcinogen and ultimately the development of the disease. So if that's true, and it's not gender specific, then the answer is, according to the gentleman that has a PhD in epidemiology, there is a causal relationship. And again, I think if we're relying or looking to rely on expert testimony to establish whether or not the evidence indicated a relationship, I think an expert in epidemiology's opinion is sufficient to establish whether or not, and I'm having to catch myself because what I wanted to say was a causal relationship, and that's not what the statute requires. It requires reasonable association. Now, to go back to the analysis in Milko, what does that then get you? The presumed fact, assuming that that the evidence establishes those basic facts. The presumed fact is that the breast cancer developed or manifested itself out of and in the course of Ms. Lawson's employment. And so if that's the presumed fact, then the question, and again, I think we would agree, it's not a conclusive presumption, so the city had the ability to bring forth evidence to attempt to rebut that presumed fact, either by attacking the base facts or the presumed fact, which they attempted to do by producing medical evidence in the form of Dr. Petrucci. And then it becomes a question as to the fact finder as to whether or not they were persuaded that that opinion rebutted either the basic facts or the presumed facts. And in this case, the appeals officer's opinion was that they did not. And so at this juncture then, what the court would essentially be asked to do is to reweigh that evidence in order to determine whether or not the appeals officer's decision was in some way in error by having concluded that the evidence was not sufficient to rebut the presumed facts. And again, if you were to go to that position, essentially you would be doing that which the court has always said that it's not to do, which is to reweigh evidence, and I wouldn't ask you to do that. So again, if we're trying to analyze the case, were the base facts established? We believe they were. Were the presumed facts rebutted? We believe not. The other issue which the city raised in its brief, which hasn't been addressed yet here today, and I just want to touch on very briefly, is whether or not Ms. Lawson adequately and timely filed her notice of, in this case, occupational disease and her claim for compensation benefits. Both of the statute in question, which is NRS 617-342, which is the claim notice, and 617-344, which is the claim filing, both operate off of the same requirement, which is the limitation period begins to run when the individual has knowledge of the disability and its relationship to their employment. The determination of when Ms. Lawson had knowledge, I would submit to you, is a question of fact. She testified that she did not know that causal relationship until she made inquiry of her treating oncologist, Dr. Rowan, on January the 24th of 2005. Dr. Rowan testified as having a specific recollection that although he did not have a chart note for that date, that he did in fact talk to Ms. Lawson on that date. And at that time, they discussed whether or not her cancer was related to her employment when she asked him whether or not she should go back to work as a firefighter. And he said, you know what, I now have the benefit of additional information that I did not have before. I don't think you should go back to that type of work. The appeals officer found that's when Ms. Lawson obtained the requisite knowledge. And so, again, assuming that that's a finding of fact, then the legal question is, from that point forward, did she file, number one, the notice, and number two, did she file the claim in a timely fashion? And the answer to that is, she did. Number one, she filed the notice the same day. She had 7 days to do so, so she made the time limit there without any problem. She filed her claim on March the 3rd of 2005, which is well within the 90-day time frame that she had to file her claim for compensation benefits. So again, if you find that the appeals officer's determination was made on an adequate factual basis, which in this instance included Ms. Lawson's testimony and the testimony of her treating physician, then we would ask you to find that substantial evidence supported the position that her knowledge occurred. heard on January the 24th. And again, if that were true, then both the filing of her notice and the filing of her claim would have been done in a timely fashion. And in that regard, her claim would be compensable. Just to reiterate, our position is the statute as it states is not a conclusive presumption by its own terms. By the prior decisions of this court, this is not the type of statute that should operate as a conclusive presumption. It's a rebuttable presumption. I believe when the court reviews the record, it will find that there was substantial evidence in the record to show that Ms. Lawson established every one of the basic facts necessary for the operation of the presumption, and that the city did not provide sufficient evidence to rebut the presumed fact as determined by the appeals officer. And for that reason, I would ask that you affirm the appeals officer's decision as affirmed by the district court. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Gross. Ms. Lynn, I'll give you 1 minute to rebut. You had exhausted your time originally, but we asked you some questions.
Appreciate the courtesy. Thank you. Briefly, relative to Dr. Melius's credibility and his reliance on certain studies, I refer you to his testimony from the appeals officer hearing where he himself agreed that there was insufficient data to form a connection between these carcinogens, PAH and Menzies, and breast cancer. And I'll quote just briefly from that testimony. And specifically, quoting Dr. Melius, we have no studies that have, almost no studies that have, well, we have no studies that have looked at the risks of female firefighters that are sufficiently sized studies to be able to say, to draw a conclusion from that particular study. So we rebutted Dr. Melius's evidence with Dr. Melius's testimony. It's in the record. He himself could not make that connection when under cross-examination the specifics of each study were raised and discussed. Relative to the untimely filing.
But isn't he talking about causal connection, which is different than reasonable association in that context?
Perhaps there's a distinction in those two contexts.
Well, I guess the reason I pose the question is relates directly to the language in the statute, and there is a distinction, and it appears to be more relaxed. The words reasonably associated are quite a bit different than causal connection, certainly in the medical community.
And my understanding and my reading of this, he doesn't even get to a reasonable association. By his own testimony and cross-examination, he could not make that reasonable association.
Mm.
Again, if I may, just 30 seconds. Relative to the untimely filing issue, the crux of that issue and the factor that is most relevant is what date upon which did the claimant know of her disabling cancer condition and its relationship to her employment. That is very difficult to determine. It's our position that that date was known well in advance of the filing of the claim, which was perfected in March of 2005. There are, and it's in the records, evidence from the legislative sessions from 2003 and in 2005, I think there's a reference as well, when the statute was being promulgated, indicating that there was a knowledge as far back as 2004. Moreover, the discussion that has been referenced relative to the claimant's a meeting with Dr. Rowan. Dr. Rowan did not raise the issue a reasonable association or any kind of connection to employment. The claimant did. She went to him after post-surgery and stopped in unscheduled visit to discuss whether he believed there was an association. He did not bring this forward on his own. In fact, in the appointment that they had a week prior on January 17th, 2005, there was no discussion of it. So we asked Dr. Rowan about this specifically during the hearing. So what happened between January 17th, 2005 and January 24th, 2005? Did you all of a sudden read all the literature that had dawned on you that this is, of course, this is problematic and we must advise this law accordingly? That wasn't it. That wasn't it at all. So thank you for your time.
I think we understand your argument on that point, Ms. Lynn. To you, Ms. Lynn, and to Mr. Gross, and on behalf of the panel, we'd like to thank you for your briefing in this case and your outstanding advocacy this morning. two very talented lawyers doing a good job, and we appreciate your input. The case will stand submitted.